This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, August 6th, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, Sikhs around the world express shock and grief, and the FBI investigates possible links to domestic terrorism and white supremacy in Sunday's mass shooting. Tibetans continue self-immolations to protest Chinese rule of their homeland. And Congress leaves Washington with big issues unfinished. We'll find out what this means for the economy and for farmers. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Before dawn early this morning, Syria's Prime Minister Riyad Hijab and his family crossed into Jordan. Syrian state media reported that Hijab was fired from his post, but hours later his spokesperson, Mohammed Al-Itri, read the following statement.
Today, I declare to the masses of the Syrian people that I have defected from the terrorist murderous regime and joining the holy revolution.
Hijab is the highest level civilian official in the Syrian government to defect to date. Also today, a Syrian state TV facility in Damascus was bombed. Three people were hurt. And according to the Daily Telegraph, the U.S. Treasury Department gave approval to the Washington-based Syrian support group to provide money and other support to the rebels that would otherwise be blocked by sanctions. Vietnamese authorities detained more than two dozen people on Sunday who were protesting China's actions in a dispute over the South China Sea, a body of water that's home to vital shipping lanes and believed to be rich in oil. FSRN's Mike Ives has more.
Vietnamese security forces on Sunday detained more than 24 people who were protesting China's recent actions in the South China Sea. Human Rights Watch said the protesters were rounded up in central Hanoi and driven to detention facilities around the city. One was Le Hien Duc, an 81-year-old former elementary school teacher known for her public crusades against corruption. Duc was released early Sunday afternoon. Vietnam's communist government doesn't tolerate dissent, but occasionally allows anti-China demonstrations to occur on Sundays in its capital. Tensions are rising between China and its Southeast Asian neighbors over competing claims to territories in the South China Sea. Boats from China and the Philippines squared off there in April. In June, Vietnam claimed jurisdiction over two contested island chains in the sea. And in late July, China announced it was creating a new city on a South China Sea island and equipping it with a military garrison. Sunday's demonstration occurred at the same time as more than 100 people staged Vietnam's first ever gay pride parade in a separate part of town. Reporters covering the event did not witness any police interference. Mike Ives, FSRN, Hanoi.
A U.S. judge refused to grant bail for a Catholic Church official convicted of covering up child abuse by priests. Monsignor William Lynn was found guilty of child endangerment in June. He will remain jailed during his appeal. Health officials in central India are using GPS tracking to monitor sonograms in an attempt to control gender selection. Privacy advocates are concerned. Shreya Niazi reports.
Faced with the declining birth rate ratio of girls to boys, the Health Department of Madhya Pradesh in central India has started installing active tracking devices in sonography centers on a pilot basis. The GPS-enabled devices began transmitting data as soon as the ultrasound machines are turned on and can send video. According to the 2011 census, the sex ratio in Madhya Pradesh stands at 892 girls per 1,000 boys. State officials believe that the GPS sonogram tracking will curb illegal pregnancy terminations done for the purpose of gender selection. The Indian Radiological and Imaging Association, or IRIA, is opposed to the monitoring. They say that only about 5% of all sonography tests are pregnancy-related, and that intercepting the results of such diagnostics violates the human rights and privacy of patients. Shuranyazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
Following a deadly attack near the Egypt-Gaza border on Sunday, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi vowed to enforce security in the Sinai Peninsula. Rami Al-Maghari reports from Cairo.
Egyptian authorities called for 3 days of mourning following a deadly attack yesterday that killed 16 Egyptian soldiers and injured seven others near Gaza-Egypt border. The attack occurred as the soldiers were about to break their daily Ramadan fast. Dozens of attackers breached the Gaza-Egypt border. Egyptian authorities have indefinitely closed the Rafah crossing terminal and beefed up security in the border area. In Gaza, Hamas condemned the attacks and ordered that hundreds of underground tunnels along the border with Egypt shut down. Dr. Mohammed Saeed is a chief for security studies at the Cairo-based Al-Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies. Dr. Saeed downplays accusations that attackers were Gaza-based.
Such a form of terrorism is already present and rather deeply rooted in Sinai.
Some of the attackers were reportedly killed. The Israeli army says it killed seven Palestinians who tried to cross the Israeli border in two armored vehicles belonging to the dead Egyptian soldiers. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Cairo.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. In Wisconsin, residents and survivors are mourning the victims of Sunday's shooting massacre at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek. Six people were killed and several injured, including a police officer. The shooter, identified as 40-year-old Wade Michael Page, was killed by police. At a press conference today, a member of the Sikh community read the names of those killed.
Sita Singh, 41 years old, male. Ranjit Singh, 49 years old, male. Satwan Singh Kaleka, 62 years old, male. Prakash Singh, male, 39 years old. Paramjeet Kaur, 41 years old, female. Shubhik Singh Khatra, 84 years old, male.
Satwant Singh Kaleka, one of the founders and leaders of the Gurdwara or temple, was killed trying to stop the shooter. His son, Amar Deep, described to TMJ4 what he learned about his father's last moments.
He attacked the intruder or the shooter in the lobby after gunshots were fired, got to him, there's a blood struggle, evidence shows on the ground a blood struggle, and then my father's blood trailed back to one area and the shooter's trail towards the kitchen. And at that point, what goes through my mind is, you know, my father did his best to protect the temple, but also my family and his wife and all his friends and people that were there. And he slowed the shooter down enough so other people could get to safety. And that's, I mean, it's an amazing act of heroism, but it's also exactly who he was. There'd be no way in God's green earth that he would allow somebody to come in and do that without trying his best to stop it.
Two priests were also killed, including Parkash Singh, who'd recently brought his wife and children from India to live in Oak Creek, located near Milwaukee. The shooting began Sunday morning as congregants gathered ahead of a service. Some were preparing a community meal in the kitchen, children were downstairs studying. Although the shooter was killed, many hid for over an hour before police escorted them out. The shooting comes just over 2 weeks after another massacre in Aurora, Colorado, killed 12 and injured dozens. At a press conference this morning, Oak Creek Mayor Steve Scafidi said it's a tragic day for the community.
Oak Creek is a diverse, welcoming city. We host 23 places of worship, and the Sikh community is part of that, what makes our city strong. We will recover from this, but I want to assure everyone that we are doing everything we can, cooperating with federal agencies, local and state agencies, to get the answers we need to resolve the situation and to begin the healing process.
Multiple law enforcement agencies are involved in the investigation, including the U.S. Attorney General's Office and the FBI, which is examining whether the shooting was an act of domestic terrorism. The shooter, Wade Michael Page, is connected to white supremacist groups. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, he played in two bands that produced racist songs and imagery, and he'd associated with white supremacist musical groups and gatherings for over a decade. At today's press conference, reporters questioned FBI agent Teresa Carlson on what authorities knew about his affiliations.
We did not have an active investigation on him. prior to yesterday.
There may be references to him in various files. Those are things that are being analyzed right now. But we had no reason to believe, and as far as I know, no law enforcement agency had any reason to believe that he was planning or plotting or capable of such violence.
Was he known to the Bureau as a white supremacist, as an extreme?
I'm not going to discuss any details of specifics in terms of what constitutes a white supremacist and whether or not, you know, he fits that description at this point.
As the investigation continues in Wisconsin, Sikhs across the world expressed grief and shock. Harpal Singh is the priest at the Sikh Religious Society of Indiana. His brother-in-law is also a priest in another Sikh temple in Milwaukee. I started by asking Mr. Singh how he found out about the shooting and what was his reaction.
Somebody told me, as you heard, I heard from the news, and I called my sister this morning. She told that one person came inside. We have a service, the first service that was ended actually that time. So he came inside, entered inside. First, he shot the women when he first entered inside. And then maybe he knew before inside the every place. So he got inside the room where the other priests were sitting, actually. Two priests, he killed two priests, actually.
Do you see this as a religious hate crime?
I personally don't know what was the motive, actually. Nobody knows so far, actually, because the shooter also died from the police bullet. So this is so far the mystery there that's investigating. So what was the motive, actually? You cannot say, because unless you find out.
Generally speaking, how do you feel relations are between Sikhs living in your area and the rest of the community?
Yeah, we are very fine, actually. We don't have any problems since then. I have been living in this area, in this temple, for the last 18 years, actually. Even though I go everywhere, and this is a very small town.
That was Harpal Singh, a priest with the Sikh Religious Society of Indiana, giving us his reaction to Sunday's shooting at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. As violence continues in Syria, human rights advocates are warning of a food and agriculture crisis. Millions could be affected this year, according to the United Nations and the Syrian Ministry of Agriculture and Agrarian Reform. Wheat, barley, fruit and vegetable crops, livestock and poultry are all affected, with many farms being neglected because of the rise in fuel costs and shortage of migrant labour. The study also found rural and female-headed households are severely affected. UN Radio's Mamadou Alpha Diallo spoke to the World Food Programme's Abir Tefa about the report's findings.
The World Food Programme and FAO did a joint rapid food security needs assessment with the Syrian government. This assessment has shown us that 3 million people are in need of food, crop and livestock assistance over the coming year. Out of this number, we have 1.5 million people that need urgent and immediate food assistance over the next 3 to 6 months, especially in the areas that have been hit hard by the conflict and where we see a large population displacement.
And WFP representative and country director in Syria says that during the mission visit to Al-Hasakeh, even the richest family in a village reported having food stock for only one more month. Should we fear the worst for vulnerable people?
The situation is actually very bad for many of these families. The humanitarian situation on the ground is deteriorating. One-third of the rural population is facing very difficult times in feeding their families and putting food on the table. Economic implications of these losses are quite grave. I mean, it's not easy when a country is facing all of these civil unrest and at the same time recovering from many years of drought. The northeast of Syria and Hasakeh has particularly faced 5 consecutive years of drought.
And the assessment reports that as many as 3 million people are in need of assistance over the next 12 months. Which area are most affected by the crisis?
Mainly the rural areas. So the rural areas of Syria are affected by the crisis all over the country, whether it is in the northeast, the southeast, it is all over the country.
And what are your worst scenario right now in Syria?
The worst case scenario is that if we are not granted safe access, if we don't have enough funding to address the needs of these people immediately, the situation will get worse. We could see the Syrian agriculture completely dying, as well as, of course, the nutritional status of many families will just go completely the wrong way.
The Joint Mission final report says that the Syrian agriculture sector has lost a total of $1.8 billion this year as a result of the ongoing crisis. What are the effects of these major losses on a daily basis?
Yes, as you mentioned, the report has said that $1.8 billion have been lost in the agricultural sector this year because of the ongoing crisis, which includes losses and damage to crops and livestock. And the strategic crops which the country depend on, such as wheat and barley, have been affected, as well as all of the fruit like cherry and olive trees and vegetable production. This means that we have 3 million people who have lost their livelihoods. Farmers, small herders, which is one-third of the rural population. In addition to 10% of this number is female-headed households. So we really have a difficult situation of families that have already been suffering going really on a more difficult situation.
That was the World Food Programme's Abir Atefa discussing a new report by the United Nations and Syrian Ministry of Agriculture and Agrarian Reform about the current food and agriculture crisis facing the country. For a link to the report, go to our website, fsrn.org. Tibetans living in exile say another self-immolation took place today in Sichuan Province, China. This follows the death last week of another protester who set himself on fire in June. Dozens of Tibetans have self-immolated this year to protest against China's occupation of their homeland. More than 20 of them have died. It's often difficult to find out details about the protests, as journalists are prohibited from travelling to Tibet. But news of the self-immolation does reach exiled communities outside of Tibet, including in India's Dharamshala. The mountainous area is home to the largest Tibetan community outside of Tibet and to the government in exile. FSRN's Felix Gaitke and Gayatri Parameswaran spoke to Tibetans there about the protests and their struggle.
Hundreds of Tibetans have gathered at Dharamshala's football stadium. They're holding a candlelight vigil to commemorate those who self-immolated. People from all walks of life are here. Young children and workers, students and housewives, political leaders and Buddhist monks. They are in mourning.
And the latest report that we have says that Dorje Tsepten, 19-year-old, he passed away.
Sevang Rigsin, president of the Tibetan Youth Congress, addresses the crowd.
The Tibetan struggle over the last 53 years under Chinese occupation has been nonviolent. And all credit goes to the leadership of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Having said that, we are seeing all the self-immolations lately. And with this self-immolations, being a nonviolent struggle, we the Tibetan people does not have many options left. Self-immolations and hunger strike are the two last resorts that we have, and we don't have anything else.
On every street corner of the city, the Tibetan Youth Congress has put up posters of what they call the Burning Martyrs. They show profile photos of the protesters set against a background of fire. The posters also surround the entrance to the offices of the government in exile. Tashi, who goes by one name, is a government spokesperson.
Tibetans inside Tibet have no basic human rights at all. Particularly, the monks and nuns are being denied to practice their religion freely. For 24 hours, monasteries and nunneries are being controlled by the Chinese authority. And the Tibetans are forced to denounce His Holiness Dalai Lama.
Tashi adds that there's nothing they can do to stop the immolations.
You know, this, I think, it's all in the hands of the Chinese authorities. If they stop this wrong policy, if they really consider the grievances of the Tibetans, what are their demands, then I think there's hope that people may stop it. So it's all in the hands of the Chinese authorities, you know.
Tibet has its own national flag, currency, and a distinct culture and religion. China invaded and occupied it in 1949 for both strategic and economic reasons. In China, now those who discuss a free Tibet can still be jailed and charged with endangering state secrets. Human Rights Watch says that China maintains highly repressive policies in ethnic Tibetan areas. Most of the self-immolating protesters held official monastery positions or had been enrolled there as students. Kirti Monastery is in China's Sichuan province, an area with strong Tibetan culture. The monastery has been at the epicenter of the protests. Kanyak Sering, a monk and spokesperson of the monastery, now lives in exile in Dharamshala. He explains the self-immolations from a spiritual viewpoint.
I don't know what the self-immolators thought before they set themselves on fire, and I don't know whether they thought about the consequences of self-immolation for themselves. But what I can tell you is that they all left behind a letter or a message before they set themselves on fire. The letters are very obvious. They always hope for a free Tibet and for His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, to return to Tibet. So those are their slogans. So to my mind, they are self-immolating for other people, the 6 million Tibetan people. So it's not negative even when you look at it from a Buddhist point of view, because they are not doing it for selfish reasons, but for a greater good.
The protesters want to make sure the world knows about the situation in Tibet. The protests have now spread to neighboring countries, including Nepal and India. In March, 27-year-old Tibetan exile Jamphel Yeshi set himself on fire in India's capital, New Delhi. 2 days later, he died in hospital.
Firstly, I want to express to the sky.
Yeshi's friend Lobsang Jingpa witnessed the protest.
There was going to be a demonstration for Tibetan freedom in Delhi that day. Jamphel Yeshi didn't go with me. I reached the site by myself. I was just drinking some water, and when I turned around, I saw that someone was on fire. I rushed to the spot, and with one glance, I knew it was Jamphel Yeshi. When I got there, almost everything was burnt. I didn't throw any water on him. I stood there. Others were trying to douse the fire. There was a stench from the burning flesh.
Like all the other self-immolators, Yeshi left behind a letter. In the letter, Yeshi wrote as follows. What I want to convey here is the concern of the 6 million Tibetans. At a time when we are making our final move towards our goal, if you have money, it is time to spend it. If you are educated, it is the time to produce results. If you have control over your life, I think the day has come to sacrifice your life. The fact that Tibetan people are setting themselves on fire in this 21st century is to let the world know about their suffering and to tell the world about the denial of basic human rights. If you have any empathy, stand up for the Tibetan people. Copies of the letter are now on the walls of the Tibetan quarters in New Delhi. With Felix Gaitkar, this is Gayatri Parmeshwaran, FSRN, Dharamshala, India.
The US Congress is now on a 5-week holiday, but lawmakers left Washington with a lot of unfinished business. We're going to take a look at some of the lingering bills with FSRN's Alice Olstein. Alice, the House Republican leadership has refused to bring the farm bill to the floor. They fear a backlash from conservatives concerned about overspending. In the end, the House settled for a restoration of expired disaster programs. What does that cover exactly, and where does that leave the bill?
It only covers disaster aid related to this drought and just for livestock and tree farmers, actually. So it doesn't include all the other farming operations in the country, and it doesn't cover nearly as much as a farm bill would cover. The farm bill touches on all food and nutrition and growing policies around the country, everything from food stamps, farmers markets, conservation programs, environmental requirements for farmers, all of that. And so the Senate passed a 5-year farm bill, which is what farmers have been pushing for. They say they want that stability over time. They don't want policies changing every year. They don't want certain programs to be on the chopping block every year. And the House had a one-year bill in the works, but they didn't have the votes to bring it to the floor. And the Senate is hoping that by not acting on this disaster program, it will push the House to pass a full farm bill when they come back from this recess. They've been making all kinds of speeches that, you know, once lawmakers have to go back to their home districts and hear from their constituents, especially those who have large farming constituents, that will give the pressure needed to reauthorize this farm bill.
The Violence Against Women Act is in a stalemate. On Monday, House Speaker John Boehner did name lawmakers to negotiate with the Senate on a compromise bill to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act for 5 years. But the Obama administration said that didn't go far enough. What's at issue here, and what's the next step when Congress returns?
Like a lot of topics this congressional season, the House and Senate have passed very different bills and will now need to resolve those differences in a conference. And the major issue here is that the Senate bill extends protections to other vulnerable groups, groups vulnerable to the kind of violence the bill hopes to combat, specifically undocumented women, Native American women, and the LGBT community. And the House has cut those groups out of the programs and protections of the Violence Against Women Act, which has been around since 1994. And the president has said he would veto a bill that does not include those vulnerable groups in its protections.
Tell us about another big stalemate, that one's with tax cuts. President Obama proposed allowing tax cuts for the wealthy to expire. What was in the Senate and House measures, and where do the bills stand now?
This is another instance in which the House and Senate have passed very different bills, and they're going to need to hash out the issues. The Bush tax cuts will expire at the end of the year, so a policy has to be set before then. And the Senate has voted to let the tax cuts for the wealthy, those making over $250,000 a year, expire so that the added revenue from those taxes on the wealthy will be able to fund programs and fund the country. The House has voted to extend the Bush-era tax cuts for all income levels, and they are saying that raising taxes on anyone during this difficult economic time will hurt the recovery effort. The president has said he will veto the bill to extend those tax breaks for the wealthy. And so this is another instance in which it is likely to get right down to the wire, right down to the deadline, as each side defends its position.
So frustrating stalemates on all fronts, but Congress has managed to pass some pieces of legislation, but really not much in terms of new laws or policies. Can you just tell us about some of the key items that did actually get through?
Right. As you said, most of what they've passed this session has been extensions of current policy. And a lot of those had to get right down to the deadline before they were passed. And some of the major ones this session have been keeping the federal student loan rate from doubling, also extending the payroll tax cuts, extending unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed, of which there are many, many in this country right now. One major piece of legislation was the transportation bill, and while it's an extension of the past transportation bill, there are some big changes, including large cuts to public transportation around the country, as well as bicycle and walking programs that many people depend on. Those are hurting.
Alice Olstein, our Washington, D.C. correspondent, thanks very much for your time again.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Komp and Nell Abram, who also produced today's headlines. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. A special thanks to our Washington, D.C. intern, Ness Smith-Savadoff. We wish him the best in his future work and endeavours. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.